This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. In our first two segments today, we're going to talk about China. This Asian giant has been making some extremely bold moves lately. A Chinese firm has acquired the largest port in Panama, cementing China's control over one of the world's most important sea gates. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Callum Wood about why this is concerning. Then we're going to follow that with a conversation with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about China's 100-year strategy. We're going to see how this is really part of a long-term plan that China's been working on to position itself as the superpower of the future. In our third segment, we're going to look again at the Orlando massacre, and we'll talk about something that I consider an astonishing aspect of the national conversation, and that is the fact that a lot of people are saying the real blame for this Islamist terror attack really lies at the foot of Christians who are opposed to homosexuality. I'm going to tell you why I think this represents a new low in American morality. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. China is on a roll in an apparent quest to become master of the seas. We've talked quite a bit about its building islands in the South China Sea, but it's also acquiring a number of already existing strategically important seaports, and it's increasing its control over global maritime trade. The latest of these acquisitions is a Chinese company that has acquired Margarita Island. This is the largest port in Panama. It's right near the Panama Canal, and this Chinese company has some big plans for this port. And to tell us about this and why we really need to be paying attention to what's happening here, we have Trumpet writer Callum Wood via Skype from our office in Australia. Hello, Callum.
Hello there. Thanks for having me on the show.
So I told you we'd have you on again. Here it is just a week later, and here we are. So first of all, you wrote an article last December about this Chinese company acquiring the port of Darwin, Australia. This is the same company that's involved in this Panama acquisition. Maybe you can just start by telling us a little bit about what happened in Darwin.
Okay, well, in Darwin, this caused a lot of ripples. It's picked up some media attention here because the deal that was made was with this company. The company's name is Landbridge, and it's a Chinese company. It claims to be a private company. And what happened was the government made a deal with Landbridge and effectively handed over control of the port of Darwin for 100 years. And that's just a staggering length of time. Technically, it's 99 years, but effectively 100 years of control by this private Chinese company. And what irritated a lot of people was that this company wasn't really vetted, and the deal was very hush-hush. Even President Obama didn't know about it until it was signed on the dotted line.
What is it that makes Darwin such a crucial port for Australia?
Well, it's Australia's main northern port. Obviously, geographically, it's situated just off Indonesia, just off the Straits of Malacca, and just south of the South China Sea. So a lot of commercial shipping goes through that region. A lot of military shipping does as well. The United States holds a port, or holds a base there in Darwin, and so does the Australian Navy, docks a lot of its military ships there. And we rely on that, as we did historically in the war days even, as a main base of operations to extend reach into Indonesia, into the South China Sea. And so now we have this Chinese company, this Landbridge group, that's effectively come in, taken control. And so now a lot of the port operations, any activity that goes on in that port, has to be run through the Landbridge company, a Chinese company.
So essentially the story here seems to be that Australia has this was an acknowledgement of just how close its ties to China has become. It's really the reason why President Obama was irritated by this was it showed how China is really prioritizing its relationship with China over that of the United States and sacrificing its own territorial integrity and its own security in the process. So it serves as kind of a good lead into what's happening here in Panama. When you were talking about this, you mentioned that ostensibly the LandBridge Group is a private company, but maybe you can just tell us more about this.
Yes, well, private companies in China have a tendency to not be very private. A lot of them are interwoven with the Chinese government, and LandBridge is no exception to that rule. When they weren't really vetted and this news story was picked up, a lot of the news sources actually dug a little bit deeper into LandBridge's past, and they reveal some really startling information. I'll give you some examples. For instance, this LandBridge Group is deeply connected with the Chinese government. For one, they help with a lot of the military exercises of the Chinese government. LandBridge supplies a lot of its technology, a lot of its scientific research. It goes to the Chinese military. They even help with logistics during military or naval exercises. A lot of their personnel work alongside the military. And even the CEO of LandBridge Group is himself, I'll have to read you his official title in the Chinese government because it is quite long. He is a senior member of the 12th National Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference Committee. And that's quite a mouthful. But basically, he is part of the government. He's a leading member in this committee. And like many of the committees in China, it helps regulate a lot of companies. So the LandBridge Group, for instance, It is heavily regulated, and just to ensure that it doesn't stray beyond the Chinese Communist Party lines, and so that it is fulfilling their wishes and striving towards their goals and aspirations.
So it's not at all a stretch to say that this LandBridge Group is essentially executing the desires of the Communist Party of China.
That's exactly right. They tend to work in step with the government. And another factor that would point to this is the fact that the LandBridge company actually sponsors its own militia. And I don't know too many private companies that go ahead and do this, but the LandBridge company has the People's Armed Militia, they call it. And it's sponsored and trained by this private company.
Okay, so let's talk about the port that they just acquired here, Margarita Island. Why is this so important?
Well, Margarita Island Port is incredibly significant because it is situated right on the Atlantic mouth of the Panama Canal. We know we've talked extensively on the Trumpet about the importance of the Panama Canal as a key trade route between the Pacific and the Atlantic, interconnecting those two. And it just sees an enormous flow of trade through there. Now, the Margarita Port is the largest port on the Atlantic side, and that's just been purchased for about $900 million by the LandBridge Group. And it's situated in a very crucial area. It's called the Colon Free Trade Zone. And this free trade zone was established back in 1948, and it has about $5 billion worth of imports and exports traveling through there annually. So it's a really busy, busy trade zone. One of the most important, people say, in the whole region. And it sees about 12,000 merchant ships travel by annually. So you can just see how vital the ports are in that zone, that they see all of this trade coming through. Everything that flows through the Panama Canal has to pass by these ports.
Now, we talked quite a bit about the fact that when America's lease over the Panama Canal was up, that it was a Chinese company, Hutchison Whampoa, that took over the port, the mouth at both ends of the Panama Canal. it seems like this is kind of another piece in that chain that secures China's control over that whole strategic port.
That's exactly right. The two ports that China originally bought when it did take control, when Hutchinson Whampoa did take control, were Balboa and Cristobal. And both of those are also major ports at each end. So now you can see with this latest acquisition that China's really just cementing its hold over the whole region. Even if it loses control of one port, it still has many more, and it still has a lot of facilities that it runs there. Not only did it take control of the ports, but when the US pulled out, the Chinese actually took control of a lot of the military installations, and has since that time they've continued to consolidate power and upgrade and build, which is why the Panamanians originally sold them the rights to control and sold them these ports. China promised to do them up, and the Panamanian government, in need of money, did acquiesce and sold these.
So it was the Panamanian government that was in control of Margarita Island before yes. the Chinese took it over. And what's so what are some of the promises? What's China's plans with this port?
Well, the Landbridge Group has been really quick to talk about what it plans on doing. It is going to really upgrade and modernize the entire region there. It's talking about building four deep water ports. Now, at the moment, the Panama Canal is being upgraded. It's set to open some new locks and the new gates on June 26. And that'll allow for ships about three times the size of the current ships that are sailing through there. So we can see a real increase in traffic coming through the Panama Canal as these new possibilities are opened up to ships that can now take more goods through more often.
And that was also a Chinese initiative.
Also a Chinese initiative. That's exactly right. And that just points to China's work in the region and shows just how vital they see this Panama Canal as. Now, it's going to cost quite a great deal for the Landbridge Group. They're paying $500 million up front and another $400 million on upgrades. They're expected to make a container terminal there at the new port that'll house up to 2.5 million 20-foot shipping containers. So this absolutely enormous project that they're undergoing there.
So maybe we can just try to put this in context, both in terms of China's overall activities, seagoing activities and acquisitions all over the world, and also its context with respect to biblical prophecy, because we've talked a lot about biblical prophecies of America and Britain losing control over sea gates. Now, this is one that wasn't necessarily specifically owned by the United States before this, but the fact that other enemy nations would acquire sea gates that would be strategically important to U.S. and British interests is very significant. But that also prophecies that we've talked about with the America being besieged at some point and foreign countries like China having a significant role in that. Anything that you could help to establish the importance of why we need to be watching this?
Yeah, not a problem. Well, we've seen a lot of news headlines coming out of the South China Sea and China's belligerence there. They've been building up these man-made islands. They've been aggressively pursuing their foreign policy in the region. They've been bullying their neighbors, as China has a history of doing. And we've also seen the Chinese buying up a lot of ports, like the Port of Darwin, like Margarita Port now in Panama. And what this does, and what a lot of the media sources are beginning to notice, is that not only do these purchases fulfill China's economic goals, but they also fulfill strategic military goals for the Chinese government. The military wants to extend further. The Chinese military, it wants to extend its reach and aggressively push back at U.S. interests in the South China Sea and other regions in the Pacific. And to do so, it needs supply lines. It can't extend its military without the backing of key trade routes and ports for its ships to dock at. So any harbors that we might see China buying and upgrading, they might be able to house trade vessels, but at the same time, a lot of them can also house the military vessels. And that's the key danger here, is that not only are we allowing China to extend its economic reach further, but we are actually allowing them to spread their military wings a little bit more. That's what we've seen, especially in Darwin. And that's where Panama comes into it as well. The Chinese control that entire canal system now with ports at both ends. And that really puts their hand on the spigot, so to speak. If they want to stop the flow of ships through that region, all they need to do is close off the ports at each end, and they have the ability to completely plug all access through that crucial sea lane. I have a quote here from one professor, and he was Professor Donald M. Dozer, and he was a professor at the University of California in the late 70s, and he was interviewed by the Plain Truth magazine, and he had this really chilling statement, and I think it sums it up well. This is talking about the Panama Canal. He says, "Upon the defense of the canal zone by the United States depends the fate of the canal. Upon the fate of the canal depends the safety of world sea lanes and the fate of the entire Caribbean Gulf area. Upon these factors depends the survival of the United States as a free and independent nation and the safety and welfare of the American continents." And that's just a really powerful statement, because really that defense is now hinging upon China. China is the one who defends the Panama Canal and controls who comes and goes, and controls whether or not that port stays open. And so this really starts to play into those prophecies that you mentioned there. We've talked a lot about the prophecies about our enemies holding our gates, possessing our gates, because it was a promise originally, we know, made to the patriarch Abraham. Almost 4,000 years ago, God made that promise to him, and we have it recorded for us in Genesis 22, verse 17, and 24:60. And God promises these blessings, and that's what we saw. We've seen, for the last 200 years, we've seen the British Empire controlling sea gates around the world, just everywhere you can think. Gibraltar, across the Straits of Malacca, America controlled the Panama Canal. We really did, Britannia really did rule the waves, so to speak. America had complete control and access to Asia through its island ports from Hawaii all the way across, a big influence in the Philippines and elsewhere. And now we can see all of that is being turned over to foreigners. And oftentimes we see it is the Chinese.
Very fascinating. And really, I think you can see what happened in Darwin. You can see that same kind of a strategic vulnerability that the United States would find itself in because of a failure of imagination on the part of American leaders to recognize the seriousness of the threat. And this is a story that really has gotten very little attention because people don't see the real gravity of the threat, but definitely something that we're going to surely come to recognize the mistake that we made down the road. We've been talking with trumpet writer Callum Wood about a Chinese company acquiring Margarita Island, which is the largest port in Panama. He's written an article about this subject. It's up online today at thetrumpet.com. Go there to read more about it. Callum, we really appreciate you bringing this subject to our attention.
Thanks for having me on the show again.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Now we are going to put these recent moves by China in a little more of a historical context. Americans tend to be extremely short-sighted when it comes to foreign policy and just about everything else. But China has a history of taking the long view. When President Richard Nixon visited China in 1972, Premier Zhu Enlai was asked his assessment of the 1789 French Revolution, and he said, well, it's too early to say. Trumpet writer Andrew Miller has written an article about this subject. It's due to be printed in the next edition of The Trumpet, the August edition, which we're finishing up this week. The article is titled China's 100-Year Plan, and he's here to talk about that with us. Hello, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
So you start this article by talking about a book by Chinese President Xi Jinping, The Governance of China. Why don't you tell us what this book is about and what it tells us about this long-term perspective that the Chinese tend to have?
Yes. Well, obviously, Xi Jinping's both the president of China and the secretary general of the Communist Party. So whenever he publishes a book, it carries a lot of weight in a one-party country, like a one-party dictatorship like China. It's practically almost considered scripture for the 1.3 billion people who live in China, even though it hasn't gotten a ton of press coverage outside of China. But this book, he really he outlines his vision for China in the future, kind of this concept of what other authors have called the 100-year marathon, saying that the Chinese Communist Revolution occurred in 1949. So he's saying about 100 years from then, 2049, is when he's wanting China to achieve its full superpower status on the world scene, which is really does put these moves like in the Panama Canal into context. As you know, that for a good part of the last century, we lived in a bipolar world where the United States and the Soviet Union were the two superpowers, and the Soviet Union kind of fell apart for a while, leaving the United States as the only superpower. And you'll even see a lot of people in America, they're really trumping up this idea that that's a bad thing, and we should be going back to a multipolar world where we've got Europe and we've got Russia and we've got China and we've got all America, and they've all got their all superpowers and they've all got their spheres of influence and they all kind of work together. But when you read some of this, like this book, The Governance of China by Xi Jinping, I mean, he really talks about Chinese superpower status, and he mentions Russia prominently. I think he even mentions Tanzania in Africa quite prominently. But the United States, it's mentioned like 2-3 times in the book, is kind of this far-off land that doesn't really matter much anymore.
So how much detail does President Xi get into in this book in terms of how to achieve superpower status, and how much of it have we already seen realized?
Right. Well, Xi's book's fairly general. It's more kind of like the goal he's aiming for. But he's also very close with a lot of the more nationalist generals in the People's Liberation Army, and they've written just this slew of books that do get very detailed on how China can overtake America to achieve superpower status in the coming decades. I think there's one of the authors, Colonel Lu Mingfu, who's a defense advisor for the People's Liberation Army. He's written a book called The China Dream, where he really does get this really much more blunt than even she was, saying that, no, we want China needs to overtake America as the world's superpower, and we've got a few decades to accomplish this. But he draws on a lot of history. He's saying that the main mistake the Soviet Union made when they tried to overtake America is they were just too belligerent. I mean, you had these arms races, nuclear buildups. Everyone in America was scared of them. Reagan instituted this big military buildup, and we're trying to do everything we can to stop them. He said, if we're going to overtake them, they said, we'd really need to lull America into a state of complacency. In some ways, he even brings up the example of like the fall of the decline of the British Empire, where he says that America took the top spot as the world's superpower from Britain just because they were able to convince the Britons that they were their friend, which in that case was more true than it is with America and China. It was a little bit easier of a sell. But he does just really bring that out, is that said we really need economic dominance before military dominance can be achieved. So he said we shouldn't be trying to match the United States Navy ship for ship or the United States Air Force plane for plane. You're just going to scare people and they're going to do something to stop us. He said, but if we can focus in on building our economy, and even in a large part they have built it by selling cheap exports to America. I mean, America's even helped them build that economy because it keeps our cost of living down. they said, until the point where we can, the military part can come later.
Well, you'd have to think that if they're looking at this as a 100-year marathon, a 100-year plan, like you said, from 1949, the beginning of the Communist Revolution, if they had been able to foresee where they would be, where China would be as a global power in 2016, they would have had to have been pretty pleased with the progress.
No, the Chinese would have to be very pleased. By some economic measures, their economy is actually already bigger than the United States. If you count for purchasing parity, you take what they can purchase with their currency and how much currency there is in the Chinese economy versus the United States, what we can purchase with our currency, they actually can purchase more for the based on the gross domestic product of China than the United States can. Now, if you were to convert their the yuan into dollars, you'd purchase a little of that because you'd lose in the exchange rate. But if you purchase direct, they're, by that measure at least, their economy is already bigger than the United States. And most economists estimate that by the end of this 100-year plan in 2049, even just outright, their economy would be probably about twice the size of the U.S. economy. So they're making great progress towards that goal. And I even quote another general here in this article, or actually, no, he's not a general. He's just a defense advisor, but who even brings in like some ancient, an ancient Chinese document called the Rites of Zhao that it puts forward the theory that a Chinese emperor should have a military four times bigger than his closest rival. And he's even advising the People's Liberation Army that that is the end goal, is that our military needs to be four times the size of the United States military. They said it'd just be foolish to try to do like the Russians did and build it up all at once before our economy, before we achieve economic dominance. He said, so we need to wait for another few decades until our economy, we said, once our economy, the Chinese economy is twice to three times as big as the United States economy, it would be very easy to fund a military that big and have the United States not be able to keep up with you.
So this is some very high-level strategic thinking and looking at a trend that develops over a period of decades or even longer. And this is China has a history of this type of thinking. You bring this out in your article, how this is something that we've seen even historically from China. Maybe you could give us some more historical examples of how China has taken this kind of a perspective.
Right. Well, China has a national defense university, like most nations do, to train future generals and future leaders for their military and for politics. And there's there was a group of like 21 generals at this institution that published like an anthology of books that they're almost half history books, half military strategy books, going back all the way like almost 3,000 years ago to the Warring States period, where China was divided into 8 separate kingdoms and they were all warring against each other, trying to figure out which dynasty would come out supreme before the country was united. And so they really do they look to that period to do modern strategy. I mean, I guess to get into like even some like folklore into China, or I guess like half history, half folklore, they talk about a proverb that kind of illustrates the point I was just making, calling don't ask the weight of the emperor's cauldrons. And because, of course, in ancient China, the emperor, he had these 9 big cauldrons that were like a symbol of his authority. But there was a belief if the emperor ever became corrupt, he'd lose the mandate of heaven. Or like, I guess I don't think they had a centralized god, but like the ancestors they worshipped would no longer favor him, and his power would transfer to a new dynasty. But sometimes there was a longer transition. So that gets to the story, is there was the king of one of these dynasties was reviewing his troops along with an ambassador from the dynasty that was dominant at the time. And he knew that this dominant dynasty was in decline and he was hoping to take over. So he started asking the ambassador about how much the emperor's cauldrons weigh. I guess he was already had like the measuring tape out, measuring his palace, seeing if they'd fit. And so, and this ambassador rebuked him because he said the the emperor, the old emperor, wasn't so corrupt yet that he'd lost the mandate of heaven. So he said, you've tipped your hand before the time's right that you're a rival and you want to take over. And I don't recall actually if the legend actually ever says what happened to him, but I know he wasn't the next dynasty to gain dominance. He blew his chance with tipping his hand.
So taking this back into modern day, what would be an example of how that long-term strategy rather than short-term perspective that you tend to see certainly in the United States in more recent years, but how that is playing out and how it really serves as an advantage in their acquiring of power.
Right. Well, yeah, because their population now that their one-child policy is growing and their economy is growing. So time's definitely on their side. They don't have to necessarily rush into these things. So they want to. But yeah, so by taking a long-term view and really focus on building their economy first, they can achieve global economic dominance. And that is one of the reasons they've tried to cultivate good relations with the United States, just to get their, I mean, the trade deficit is between the U.S. and China is enormous. I think, yeah, we've owed them over $1 trillion just due that they're selling us so much more than we're selling them. And then the interest on that debt, it's been a while since I actually calculated the math, but it's a large part, I mean, a huge portion, I think it's close to a third of like the funding for the People's Liberation Army, you could say, is being funded by American taxpayers off the interest on the debt that we just owe them due to this trade's deficit. So they have definitely, by manipulating their economy in such a way that America relies on them for cheap goods, have grown their economy to the point where it's almost bigger than the United States and have been able to fund their military in large part off the interest they've gained from that. So that is a strategy that takes some years to unfold. But if you're taking a long-term view, it's very effective.
And the idea would be, let's keep this going as long as it's a viable condition to make the disparity between U.S. need and Chinese provision as great as possible, to increase the amount of American dependency on Chinese goods and Chinese largesse.
Right. Keep that going as long as possible until their economy is so dominant that military power, they would have the military power to enforce whatever they need to. And there is even another section of this article that talking about, like, just in case the U.S. ever does catch on to this, they do have some military technologies they're developing that are not as overt as like what the Soviet Union tried to do with their big nuclear arms build up, like cyber weapons. There's some of these generals that saying said, we really need cyber weapons. We really need anti-satellite weapons. They said, if we ever did have to get in a fight with America over the South China Sea or Taiwan or someplace like that, they said they're so reliant on computers and they're so reliant on satellites that if we get computer virus, take down Pentagon communications and then knock out a satellite or two, they said it would take them so long to catch back up and get that fixed that we'd have whatever our military objectives achieved long before then. And they actually do even that same anthology by these 21 military generals does mention a little bit of what Callum was talking about earlier about sea gates. They said that was kind of like the three big, I guess what they call Achilles heels of America is dependency on computers, dependency on satellites, and dependency on very long overseas supply lines. It's still kind of burned in their psyche over in China that for like between 1949 and 1963, when the communist revolution had taken over there, we put sanctions against the Chinese in an attempt to try to weaken the new communist government. And the only reason we were able to enforce those sanctions is because we controlled most of the sea gates going into the South China Sea. So they're really worried that America might do something like that again, which is also a big driver for now they want to control the sea gates in the South China Sea. But to the other extent, there's also pointed out to the fact that those sea gates work in reverse too, is that if there was ever a big rift between the U.S. and China, I mean, they could put a trade embargo on us just as easily as we put a trade embargo on them if they were the ones that control some of these sea gates to cross the South China Sea, because like a third of the world's trade does go through that sea at some point.
In a sense, you could almost see the this swapping of power, or this transfer of power from the United States to China that you see happening in the world today as a referendum on two different views, and just the limitations and the problems that come from taking a short-term view, making ourselves as indebted to China as we are, having these dependencies on technologies that don't necessarily won't last, or that come with real vulnerabilities, versus taking a strategy that really does play into their hand over the long term. And I mean, we understand the overview of biblical prophecy and just how much of a role China is going to play in what happens in the years ahead, how much the United States is going to be handicapped because of, in part, its myopic view of what's happening in the world. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller. He's written an article called China's 100-Year Plan, or we actually changed it. China's 100-year strategy.
Strategy, no, yeah. I think we at the meeting yesterday we were brainstorming for that. So it's
China's 100-year strategy.
Right.
So you can watch for that article in the time ahead. It would probably be next week sometime that we would publish it on thetrumpet.com. Well, thanks for your time, Andrew.
All right, thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The Orlando massacre on June 12th that killed 50 people was shocking. It was dismaying. It was a terrible, grisly tragedy. But in some ways, I think what was even more stunning than the massacre itself was the public discussion that emerged afterward. Not more tragic, but more stunning. We're hearing from the mainstream media that a major cause for what happened in Orlando, aside from the gun control issue, which is obviously something that they're very, very strong about, a major cause was the climate of hate in America created by Christians and Bible believers. Now, you know, as the media knows, the killer, Omar Mateen, was a Muslim. He had bought into the culture of many Muslim countries. There are at least 10 countries that punish homosexuality with the death penalty, Muslim countries. The Islamic State, the terrorist organization to which Mateen pledged allegiance, boasts about throwing homosexuals off of rooftops. But after the Orlando attack, mainstream media outlets acted like Mateen's Islamist ideology had no bearing on his decision to murder these people. No, they said the real culprit was homophobia and religious intolerance. And so they painted anyone who doesn't celebrate homosexuality with the same brush as a lunatic Islamist who murders gays in cold blood. Now, this wasn't just a shoot-from-the-hip opinion offered up by a few fringers. The New York Times ran an editorial saying that you have to view Mateen's hatred toward gays and lesbians in its societal context. This is what the New York Times said. Hate crimes don't happen in a vacuum. They occur where bigotry is allowed to fester, where minorities are vilified, and where people are scapegoated for political gain. Tragically, this is the state of American politics, driven too often by Republican politicians who see prejudice as something to exploit, not extinguish. And there is a whole lot, I mean, basically the whole editorial is about the supposed bigotry against homosexuals by Republicans. It actually calls the 49 victims in Orlando casualties of a society where hate has deep roots. And it's not talking about the Islamic State. It's not talking about Muslim countries that execute homosexuals. It's talking about the United States of America, a society where hate has deep roots. In fact, this editorial from the New York Times never even mentions Islam. It never mentions the fact that Mateen was a jihadist. So apparently, the New York Times editorial board actually believes that radical Muslims are motivated to kill homosexuals because of the beliefs of Christians. This makes absolutely no sense. There was a lawyer for the ACLU who tweeted this: "The Christian right has introduced 200 anti-LGBT bills in the last 6 months, and people are blaming Islam for this. No." So this man is acting as if legal efforts in the United States to check the aggressive advancement of homosexuality and transgenderism, that somehow that is what inspired Omar Mateen to commit murder. He's speaking as if the efforts to protect our children in restrooms and locker rooms is equivalent to a terrorist gunning people down, or as if the belief that biology should determine bathroom access is the same as the notion that gays are so disgusting they should be slaughtered. He's saying that these are the same thing, that you can't blame Islam when really the Christian right is what's really to blame. And what's even more bizarre, there were some people speaking after the Orlando attack who said that those who blamed Mateen's religion were actually scapegoating Islam in order to deflect blame from Christian homophobia. This is utter lunacy. And I just find it astonishing that this kind of bizarre thinking and unhinged thinking has come to have such prominence in the United States. Now, as strange as this may seem to these folks, it's actually quite possible to believe that homosexuality is wrong, and also to believe that murdering homosexuals is wrong, that homosexuals should not be murdered. You can actually believe the Bible and you can still be appalled to see fellow human beings who are made in God's image slaughtered like the people in Orlando were. But somehow these two ideas, in the perverse view of the New York Times editorial board and so many of the liberals who are writing and speaking about this, somehow this is hypocrisy. There were commentators who mocked people who, after the tragedy, said that, you know, we should pray about this. There were some who angrily condemned people who define marriage as a union between one man and one woman. I saw an interview that CNN's Anderson Cooper did with Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi, and he was there on the air criticizing her because she was helping victims of the attack because she had previously defended Florida's constitution, which says that it defines marriage as a union between one man and one woman. And so Anderson Cooper on CNN implied that this woman was some kind of fraud for supporting the Orlando victims after she had no previous record of advocacy for the LGBT cause. There were so many examples after the Orlando attack of this kind of nonsense. The whole week after that attack, there were so many vociferous statements of support for the LGBT community, and so much advocacy in mainstream sources, and just saying this is so important. These people were wonderful Americans, and so on. And anyone who has any view contrary to that at all, anyone who's not just adamantly supportive, has no place in public discussion. And they were even being attacked I mean, anyone who wasn't so blatantly advocating it was being attacked. Somehow the big lesson that people take from this tragedy is that Americans need to become stronger advocates of homosexuality. Now, if people are honestly wondering what provoked Omar Mateen to kill homosexuals, they're not going to find a shred of it in the rapidly backpedaling effort to maintain the status quo on marriage and sex that you have in America today. There's nothing in the Christian right, as that ACLU lawyer put it, that provoked Omar Mateen to do what he did. If people really wonder what it was that provoked him to do what he did, they're going to find a lot more provocative evidence in the bold and brash and loud and proud gay rights movement that bullies people into compliance, even against their personal convictions. And that's not to defend what that horrible man did at all in committing that atrocious murder. But to think that somehow, well, we're just not advocating homosexuality enough, if we were stronger advocates of homosexuality, it would prevent this kind of thing, is an exact inversion of the truth. Just 3 years ago, I wrote a booklet called Redefining Family. And at the time, there was a tremendous amount of social pressure to accept same-sex marriage. And in that booklet, we talked about just the history behind the homosexual movement and its agenda, how the move from homosexuality being on the fringe to becoming mainstream, that it was actually the result of a very deliberate strategy that was implemented in America. And it talks about that agenda, and it talks quite a bit about how rapid the change has been within American society. The first chapter of that booklet begins this way: the younger you are, the more limited your perspective is about how rapidly society's attitudes toward homosexuality have changed. And it talks about the fact that as recently as 1996, that's just 20 years ago now, that large majorities of both houses of the U.S. Congress defined marriage as a union between one man and one woman. And Bill Clinton, who was the president at the time, a Democrat, he signed it into federal law. That was just 20 years ago. But what strikes me in looking at this booklet, Redefining Family, today, is just how out of date it is. I wrote it just 3 years ago, but in the 3 years since it was published, we have seen a tsunami of more changes on this foundational issue. We're not even debating same-sex marriage anymore. That's the law of the land now. Now, transgender is mainstream, and anybody who disapproves of it can lose his job. Ages ago, when Barack Obama became president, he publicly opposed same-sex marriage. Now, his administration is directing all public schools, even elementary schools, to give transgender children access to bathrooms and other facilities that are consistent with their gender identity, or they risk losing federal funding. So that is how rapidly things have changed. This is a phenomenal revolutionary change in America that's just happened in just very, very recent times. It was just about a year ago that the same-sex marriage became the ruling over all of America. And Hillary Clinton, the presumptive Democratic nominee for president, she opposed same-sex marriage up until 2013. The America that I grew up in is becoming unrecognizable. The space, the place for an individual to live according to the teachings of the Bible is shrinking rapidly and dramatically. Back in 1987, two homosexual activists laid out a strategy to transform public perception of homosexuality. It was an essay called The Overhauling of Straight America. I was thinking about this quote as I just thinking on all of this that has happened since the Orlando massacre. In that article, they advocated taking a restrained step-by-step approach and keeping the discussion broad and abstract, downplaying actual homosexual behavior. This is what they wrote. First, let the camel get his nose inside the tent. Only later, his unsightly derriere. Well, those men can congratulate themselves. Because today, the whole horrid beast is in the tent. And anyone who isn't willing to pretend that he's just one of the guys is being told, you need to get out. If you really want to know why this change in America is so dangerous, I would encourage you to email me at letters@thetrumpet.com and we'll send you a free copy of Redefining Family. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Callum Wood and Andrew Miller. Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with this thought from James Otis. Tyranny of all kinds is to be abhorred, whether it be in the hands of one, or of the few, or of the many. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.